Yeah, so week 5 of the Aquinas class today, we're talking about the existence of God, and I've titled this Demonstrating the Existence of God. This is really the most famous element in the thought of Aquinas, at least among philosophy students or just philosophy junkies, sometimes called his five ways to show and or to argue or to prove the existence of God, and different people prefer different words of those words depending on their, it tells us a lot about what they believe about certainty and method and stuff like that. But what's so interesting, I think, to me about this portion of the Summa Theologica is that Thomas takes the position that God's existence is not self-evident. Now, he's going to mean that in a very technical way. He's well aware of Anselm and how he quoted Psalm 14:1 at the beginning of his ontological argument that the fool says in his heart there is no God. And Aquinas quotes that to make his point. But let's hear what he means by this truth being self-evident or not. He says, I answer that a thing can be self-evident in two ways. On the one hand, self-evident in itself, though not to us. On the other, self-evident in itself and to us. So consider the difference, for example, between A equals A, as opposed to, say, man is rational. Now, both of these are what he's going to mean by self-evident in itself and to us, but in our day and age, I would venture to say that this is self-evident in itself and to us, but this is self-evident in itself, but not to us. Because we've lost focus. Now, granted, most people aren't even really going to know what this is either. That's another story altogether. But that predicate, we don't even know what that means. So I think that's a good demonstration today of what he means between the difference between these things. But he goes on, he says, a proposition is self-evident because the predicate is included in the essence of the subject, as man is an animal. Now that also is not self-evident today, because we don't mean the same thing by animal. For animal is contained in the essence of man. If therefore the essence of the predicate and subject be known to all, the proposition will be self-evident to all. So Thomas's concern here is with method. If you ask Aquinas, when is a thing self-evident in itself? He would mean the thing itself. It is evident in the sense that it is certain about that thing. So here's the object, doesn't matter what it is, a tree or anything else, and here's the subject looking at that. And so we tend to think of this as the self. Okay, and so when we say self-evident, what do we usually think that means? Evident to myself, meaning I give it thumbs up. And so if a thing is self-evident, it means everybody, or at least most normal people, give it a thumbs up. And of course, that's not what the word self-evident meant in the Middle Ages. But he does make this distinction because he is concerned about method. So in both definitions he gives, the objective and the subjective sense, he regards the objective sense to remain intact. So the learned might understand, for example, and here's one other example he uses, that incorporeal substances are not in space. But that's not self-evident to the unlearned. So he says, likewise, until we grasp that God exists... Sorry, I paraphrased him there, so this is me. Until we grasp that God exists is analytically the case. In other words, the idea of existence is contained in the concept, the essence of God. But most people don't understand what that means. So for someone that doesn't understand that, he says the proposition needs to be demonstrated by things that are more known to us, though less known in their nature, namely by effects. So this is why a lot of people think that Aquinas is an empiricist, because he's taking things down here, he's starting with particulars. But why is he doing that? Not because they're more real, but because we're more simple. And now I mean simple as in not as rational. We're not as learned. So we start down here with things that we're more familiar with, and then we're able to kind of ascend or draw a circle around that. Okay? So that's what he's concerned about, is this idea of method. So, here's what we're going to look at today. 5 different ways to argue for God's existence. Now, if you first come to philosophy and you run into Aquinas, for whatever reason, or if you're a Catholic and you're tempted to worship him or something like that, whatever it is, you might get the idea that this means these are the five ways to argue for God's existence. And we're not saying that at all. There's many different species of arguments that are, that belong to this subject called natural theology. But for Aquinas, these are his five ways to argue for the existence of God. And here's the way I've categorized them. In your notes, these make up the 5 points for today. The first way is the argument from motion to a prime mover. Notice, by the way, in all of them, we're going to be going from to. So I'm going to put from down here. Remember, from effects. To something. So, in the first one, the first way is from motion to a prime mover. The second way is from cause, namely efficient causes in particular, to an uncaused cause or to a first cause. The third way is going to be from contingency or contingent beings to necessary being. The fourth way is going to be from the idea of gradation to a most perfect being. And the fifth way, from ends or designs or directedness in this world to an ordering mind. And the big idea, very simply, is that the existence of God, according to Aquinas, can be shown in five ways. Now, interestingly, this second question of God's existence is broken down into three articles. The first article is whether or not self-evident, already covered that, what he means. The second one, though, if God's existence is not self-evident in that subjective sense, and you want to help somebody, which is why he's doing this, then the question for the theist who would communicate to, say, an atheist or an agnostic is this: can God's existence be demonstrated? So that's Article 2. Is it demonstrable? And he answers yes. And that's where he cites Romans 1:20 to justify his methodology. What's his methodology? It's moving from the things that have been made to God. Because what does Romans 1:20 say? After it says in verse 19, in case anybody's worried that, oh, this is autonomous reasoning, this is reasoning that is unaided or apart from revelation. Well, what did he say in verse 19? Verse 19, that which may be known about God is evident to them because he has shown it to them. For, here's verse 20, ever since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, in other words, the things of God, including his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, where? In the things that have been made, so that they are without excuse. So you see what's going on here. His methodology is going from here to here, not because he believes these are more important, not because he believes they're more real, not because he thinks you can go from here to here on your own. So all of that should be, all those dragons should be totally slain by this point. Okay? So, he reasons that when an effect is better known to us than its cause, from the effect we proceed to the knowledge of the cause. That's exactly how Jesus ministered, by the way. He met people where they were. He gave them real bread, even though he said in the same breath, your problem is you want bread. Here's some bread. Okay? That's the way God condescends to our level. It's not a bad thing. One more fairly important thing to keep in mind. These five ways are called ways simply because they are summaries. If you want a stricter proof, in his actual apologetics work called the Summa Contra Gentiles, he, for example, in the first way, he's going to dedicate one paragraph here in the Summa Theologica, and that's where skeptics tend to read about it, in the summary in the Summa Theologica. But that same one paragraph first argument is 31 paragraphs in the Summa Contra Gentiles. And so, what's my point? My point is that very often, atheists are attacking the summary, in other words, in the form of a way, instead of going to the actual, stricter, philosophical argument itself. So, for our purposes, we'll read the summary in the Summa Theologica. Here's the first way. The first way is from motion to a prime mover. So let's put way number one down here in this first X. We'll put the word motion. And up here, we'll put the word prime mover. The same direction is going to happen in all of the arguments. But that's the first way. Now remember, he's arguing what's called a posteriori. From effects to causes. And so here, motion is that familiar effect that we all observe and we all understand in everyday experience. So, he begins, quote, and by the way, you have the entire text in your notes. This is the entire text of the five ways. I interspersed my comments throughout in my own notes here. I don't know if I do that in yours, but it's the entire text. So, quote, the first and most manifest way is the argument from motion. It is certain and evident to our senses that in the world, some things are in motion. He's talking very modestly. Of course, in our world, everything's in motion. Now, whatever is in motion is put in motion by another. For nothing can be in motion except it is in potentiality to that toward which it is in motion. Remember that language? Potential, actual. Potential, moving, actual. Scrap of lumber, table. Whereas, a thing moves inasmuch as it is in act. For motion is nothing else than the reduction of something from potentiality to actuality. So you see why we did. When I was 22, first reading this, I didn't have somebody do this for me. Here, Matt, this is what he means. Scrap of lumber, table. Scrap of lumber on the left, let's label that number one. Table on the right, let's label that number two. Oh, that's pretty simple. We'll call this potential. The nature of the wood is potentially this. It is not potentially a bouquet of flowers, nor do you get that out of that. This is the actualization. But we all know that you can't just leave that in your garage and come back the next morning and see a table there. Something you would have reasoned that something had to happen. You need a third thing. And remember, we call that a substance in act. These are both substances, any particular thing. But you need some prior action. In this case, the saw. Right? So we saw that. So when he uses the word reduction, he means reducing the nature of this to that and not a baseball bat and not a shelf or whatever else. And so we're going to call this reducing to this. Okay, that's all he's going to mean by that. So hopefully you can see why we did that crash course in Aristotle 101. Okay? So he continues. Quote, but nothing can be reduced from potentiality to actuality except by something in a state of actuality. See the third thing. In a state of actuality, you need a third thing prior. Thus, that which is actually hot as fire makes wood, which is potentially hot, to be actually hot, and thereby moves and changes it. Now, it is not possible that the same thing should be at once in actuality and potentiality in the same respect, but only in different respects. For what is actually hot cannot simultaneously be potentially hot. Stop. You say, no, yeah it is. There's degrees of heat. I know. Pick two of them. 81 degrees and 82. Are those the same thing? No. Then they're different objects. Different moments, different times, different positions. That's all he means. But only in different respects. For what is actually hot cannot simultaneously be potentially hot. But it is simultaneously potentially cold. It is therefore impossible that in the same respect and in the same way, a thing should be both mover and moved. In other words, that it should move itself. Therefore, whatever is in motion must be put in motion by another. So everybody following so far, we're two-thirds through this argument. And all he said so far, he's moved from the necessity of that third thing. That was his first point. The necessity of a substance in act. In other words, an ever more primal mover. To the logical contradiction in supposing that any substance could be this for itself. So he's done two things. The first thing he's done is that you need something already in act for this thing called motion, this arrow. And the second thing he's done is to say, this cannot be the cause of itself. Which is just to say, self-creation is incoherent. That's really all he said in a very simple way. In other words, he's just briefly and subtly added that one cannot get off his train of reasoning by resorting to self-creation. Well, next comes the finish. I can't imagine anybody disagreeing with what he said so far. If anything, you're like, so? Or, and? Okay, here's the last part. If that by which it is put in motion be itself put in motion, then this also, love the old thinker's way of talking like this, must needs be put in motion by another, and that by another again. But this cannot go on to infinity, because then there would be no first mover, and consequently no other mover, seeing that subsequent movers move only inasmuch as they are put in motion by the first mover, as the staff moves only as it is put in motion by the hand. Therefore, it is necessary to arrive at a first mover, put in motion by no other, and this everyone understands to be God. So all he said in that last point is that you can't, this is either an unmoved mover or itself needs a mover. And so on with another and another. By the way, keep this in mind. Notice we're not going this way. We'll do that in a second. But all we're saying right now is that this, the example he uses is the staff being moved by hand. Okay? That's going to be important, that kind of motion, and you'll see why in just a little bit. Okay? But the point is that you can't have an infinite regress of substance in action that is set in motion by something else. Otherwise, the process would never get started. The way I say it to the kids is, if I have an incline, and I'm going to drop a ball down the incline, and I raise it another foot, as I'm raising my hand, by the way, the incline is built out another foot, and raise it another foot, and raise it another foot, how far, if I was to go on forever doing that, when would I drop the ball? And their answer is, well, you never would, because you would keep going at a higher and higher plane. And of course, you want to drop it from the end. And I say, okay, that is exactly right. So you see that if I don't ever have a first motion, then I can't have a second motion. And if I don't have a second motion, I can't have a third. And so on and so on and so on. And therefore, I could never have had this motion operating this. Well, let's consider the most famous objections to Thomas's first way. And we're going to spend the most amount of time on objections to this first argument, because I think you're going to see the other four are very much related to this exact kind of reasoning. But anyway, contemporary philosopher Anthony Kenny has mistaken this reasoning of Aquinas to be saying that whatever is of X nature must only be set in motion by X nature, same nature. Okay? And so what he does is he does what so many others do when they're reading this. They fixate on the particular physical example that Thomas uses, as if he's trying to engage in some pre-scientific speculation about fire. Okay? And that's not the point at all. In other words, what they're imagining here is Aquinas arguing that whatever is on fire, for example, remember he mentioned fire and heat, whatever's on fire must only be caused by something else on fire. And so Kenny refutes this. I have my quotation fingers up for people in audio land. He refutes this first way by showing us what happens when you rub two sticks together, which, if I can interpret for a second, is your tax dollars at work again at the best universities in the land. No, that is not what Aquinas is saying. Thomas's argument is rather that whatever is on fire in the effect can only be set in motion by something like those two sticks. In short, you need two things. It has to be something in act and proportionate in its power to effect just that sort of motion. So when he talks about fire heating up wood, it's not that fire has to cause fire, but that something proportionate with the power to produce heat has to cause it. Well, another objection is to go right to the upshot of the argument and suppose that Aquinas is begging the whole question in his inference. In other words, the reply is, it does not follow that we observe that from what we observe, there can't be an infinite series of motions. But here we have to make a distinction between what we sometimes call locomotion and motion per se. Locomotion meaning the motion on the observable plane of time and space. So this right here. This hitting into this, this hitting into this, this hitting into this. By the way, when this is done hitting into this, this is the motion. It doesn't even matter what's going on back here and stuff like that. Why can't that go on forever? Okay? We'll talk a little bit more about that in just a little bit. But that's the idea. I don't have to suppose from all this motion going on right now that that can't go on forever. Okay? So one of the most important things that we're going to look at in the early going, let me erase this and just draw this smaller because I'm going to need to fit it. No, do the whole thing. Is the difference between locomotion, namely on the plane that we can see, time and space, as opposed to what we saw before, essential motion. So this is on this plane. And this is going to actually touch on several of the objections. One Thomist scholar, we've already mentioned him, Edward Fezzer, says the same thing in distinguishing between what he calls a causal series ordered per accidents, in other words, accidentally. So you have a causal series, and the example he uses is Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph in the act of begetting. So in other words, when I see Abraham, I see how he begets Isaac, such that without the begetting, no Isaac. But once he's begotten Isaac, he has nothing to do with Jacob begetting Joseph. So I don't need him. Now, they're not saying that you didn't need that to happen first. But when I see these motions, I see an ordered series per accidents. In other words, I'm looking at locomotion. I'm seeing things, I'm observing things like that, kind of like the pendulum thingy. Okay, versus what he calls a causal series ordered per se, or essentially. And so this first example, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob begetting. In that series, not one of the subsequent acts of begetting is dependent upon the continued being of the prior act. Once Abraham dies, Jacob can still have kids. Now, for the second, we'll use Thomas's own example of the staff being moved by the hand. So, in other words, when you heard that in Thomas's own argument, the staff being moved by the hand, Fezzer adds a couple things in there. See, I'm a... Oh boy, this is a hand, trust me. There's a hand, there's a staff, and then he puts in a rock, and that rock is moving a fallen leaf. Okay? If I take away Abraham at this point, I don't necessarily take away this act of beginning. In other words, the power of his being is not necessary. On the other hand, if I take away the hand, I take away the staff, and then the rock and the leaf. These things are not moved. So you see that? There's simultaneous cause and effect here. And this, by the way, if you're wondering, is a clue as to why Thomas and Thomistic scholars, followers of him, can, in a sense, they're not so much that they're agreeing with Aristotle on this. Obviously, Christians, they believe that God created the universe, and so for theological reasons, they believe that the universe had a beginning in time. But I think what Aquinas would say is that you can't show philosophically that motion on this plane needed a first cause. And of course, I think there's two reasons why you can. But just get this. Even if you couldn't show that, you would still need a first mover and a first cause. Because you would still have to explain at every point on the space-time continuum, the way we would call it today, a simultaneous cause and effect chain. Without the hand, the leaf doesn't move because all of the other instrumental causes, all the other secondary causes are not put into effect. Okay? So here we're using the term secondary cause to mean all of the other causes within the first cause. So the main reasoning of Aquinas does not go like this in his cosmological argument. It goes at every point of infinite density on the number line like that. And there's no way to get around that. I brought up the cosmological argument one time to a math professor at BSU, and they said, well, you're just thinking linearly. Thank you. And so I said, what about this, and this, and this, and the infinity of infinities? I'm like, I don't know what to do with that. And you can't. So Aquinas' argument is actually better if you just ignore what he said about Aristotle on that point. Okay? Yep.
So is that why the Hume who dismantled it also in quotes,
yeah,
the law of cause and effect?
Right, and that's why Hume was trying to do it. But it's pretty clear that Hume didn't even understand this part. And it's hard to think. This is easier to picture things. It's harder to understand that, but it's much more irrefutable. Yeah. Well, Kenny raises another objection. That the first mover, if you buy into this, has to be stationary, not himself in motion. So if every motion needs another motion, then he has to be in motion. Or else he has to be simply inert. Now here we're arriving at the limits of language. When we speak of motion a posteriori, in other words, from what I observe in this world on upward to essential motion, we're already assuming in our first step something much more like locomotion than essential motion. So any ideas such as the law of inertia, namely that bodies at rest tend to stay at rest and bodies in motion tend to stay at motion, we're already assuming a body, which God doesn't have, along with temporally ordered conceptions of motion and rest, which God is not subject to time. So it has to be remembered that if the essence of motion is metaphysical and not physical, then it will not fundamentally be the sort of thing to which the principle of inertia can speak. So many reasons, the objections against the first way fall to the ground. And there's no, if you want to fault it for its simplicity, you may have to recalibrate your expectations of things being simple and complex in this world. Perhaps simple things might be the most profound. But there's no real argument against Aquinas' first way. It absolutely makes good on his claim. The second way from cause to an uncaused cause. And there I mean specifically from efficient causes in this world to a first cause. So let's draw this second down here. We're going to notice efficient causes in this world. And remember what an efficient cause is. I'm really looking at the plane of locomotion, and this is the efficient cause. There's a bunch of other, there's formal causes, there's the matter, there's the end. But when I say efficient cause in this world, I mean on the most basic level, cue ball going into the eight ball. Forget about friction, forget about rotation, forget about anything else. I just mean the simple one bumping into the simple two. Now, when you look at this second way, you might think to yourself, wait a minute, how is this second argument any different from the first, except maybe in the second he uses the word cause instead of the word motion? Well, it's not just a word difference. Gilson suggests that the first way deals with why things undergo change, while the second deals with why things exist at all. So, Aquinas begins. He says, quote, "The second way is from the nature of the efficient cause. In the world of sense, we find there is an order of efficient causes. There is no case known, neither is it indeed possible, in which a thing is found to be the efficient cause of itself. For so, it would be prior to itself, which is impossible. Now, in efficient causes, it is not possible to go on to infinity, because in all efficient causes following in order, the first is the cause of the intermediate cause. And the intermediate cause is the cause of the ultimate cause." Stop right there. He just used that in a way that might trip you up, and I noticed that, so let me deal with it. He says the first is the cause of all the intermediate causes. And the intermediate cause of the ultimate... Stop. Wait a minute. I thought ultimate meant first or efficient. Yes, in the way that we're talking about it, but remember, there's what was called the cause of causes. So there were two causes that belonged to the primary level. The actor, that's the efficient cause, and the end cause, his reason for action. So I believe when he uses the word ultimate there, he means end. Okay? Ultimate or where it's going. Okay? So just to insert that in so you don't get lost in the midst of the argument wondering why is he using that expression like that. Okay. So, you got that so far? If you don't have an efficient cause, you don't have the intermediate causes. In other words, if you don't have the pool stick, you don't have the cue ball rotating, and therefore, of course, you can't hit the eight ball into the corner pocket, and therefore win the game. So, whether the intermediate cause be several or one only. Now, to take away the cause is to take away the effect. Therefore, if there be no first cause among efficient causes, there will be no ultimate nor any intermediate cause. Must have inhaled chalk this morning or something. Jaws are not working. But if inefficient causes, it is possible to go on to infinity, there will be no first efficient cause. Neither will there be an ultimate effect, nor any intermediate efficient causes, all of which is plainly false. Therefore, it is necessary to admit a first efficient cause to which everyone gives the name of God. Again, ball, infinite plane. If it goes to infinity, at what point do I let the ball go? Answer, I don't. Okay? So if you can't have a first moment, you can't have a second. If you don't have a third, you can't have a fourth. Therefore, you can't have the moment before this one. And this moment would have never arrived. So, that's the basic cosmological argument. You see it, I think, even clearer in the second way. So, let's get right back to facing objections. The most famous for my money is that posed by both John Stuart Mill and Bertrand Russell, both of whom experienced the profound brain gas that if everything requires a cause, and if God is a thing, then God requires a cause. Oh my goodness, you guys are professional philosophers? That's not the law of cause and effect. Did you hear that from a 5-year-old and launch out on a career in philosophy and remembered it that way? The law of cause and effect is that every effect has a cause, not that everything has a cause. Aha. Okay, I see where you're going. Well, you're just defining God that way. True, I plead guilty. But the burden of proof is on you to show how that's incoherent. Not on me. You could see this at the popular level when it's demanded, oh yeah, then what caused God? Difficult to answer, actually. Because anybody so deluded as to consider that profound and clever is probably not in the right frame of mind to consider things more deeply. But at any rate, Russell at least reached a little bit deeper into his mathematician's bag of tricks to try to refute the second way. In his History of Western Philosophy, he places the first four ways in the category of depending, quote, upon the supposed impossibility of a series of having no first term. Term. I smell an equivocation already. But he says, quote, every mathematician knows that there is no such impossibility. The series of negative integers ending with -1 is an instance to the contrary. So two problems with Russell's complaint. First, by representing the members of the series in question as terms, Russell equivocates from the substantial realm. Remember, cause and effect, we're talking about things with natures causing other things with natures. We're not talking about merely theoretical or formal propositions. So it's an equivocation. Second, following Hume, it seems that Russell was conceiving of cause and effect as a description of an observational grid, so that the series of things he's observing in his own mind could remain again purely formal, such that negative integers could easily represent that backward march forever. But that is to misunderstand the object of the proof. So, he doesn't really deal with what Aquinas was dealing with. Yes, we've seen a number line, Bertrand. We know how that works. That doesn't necessarily correspond to things. All right, Immanuel Kant took a stab at the second way, very much following Hume's skepticism of the being of cause. in asserting, this is Kant's objection, that the realm of cause and effect cannot be applied to any reality beyond the senses. Stop. Well, that's an assertion, but it's going to be a dogmatic assertion with no argument attached to it. This assertion begs the very question that it concludes. Now, of course, if we followed Kant and we reduced causality to what we can observe empirically, then it may be asked whether we ever observe the principle of cause and effect. I would ask Kant, what caused you to observe the principle of cause and effect? Since you've reduced all things that you can know to cause and effect, and then you've reduced cause and effect to things going on in here, do we really observe the principle of cause and effect? In fact, that was the very thing that Hume called into question. So that for Kant to restrict cause and effect to the reality of observation, in other words, I'm no longer talking about things causing things, I'm talking about what I observe. So isn't that out there? Okay, well then talk about what's out there, not talk about your own mind and how you're tracking with it. That invalidates all cause and effect, which is exactly what Hume did. In other words, Kant's objection doesn't merely beg the question, it contradicts itself. Now, as far as Hume is concerned, he famously argued that no first cause is necessary to assert, and it's perfectly intelligible for there to be a never-ending series of effects. Now, if you want to get more deeply into this, we're going to do a class on Hume and a class on Kant, so we're going to go there. But again, this idea treats causation the same way that objections to the first way were treating motion. So if you remember what's wrong with that, only dealing with things on a local, or in this case, temporal plane, you're going to see what's wrong with this. If that was all there was to it, Thomas would probably agree with Hume that the eternal duration of the universe cannot be disproven philosophically. But the point is just that this is not all that there is to causality. In a series of simultaneously ordered causes, there would still have to be a first cause in the here and now at every point. Again, remember the arm, staff, rock, leaf. Take away one, chop off the arm, the leaf is not moving. If it does, it's going to move by some other cause and you're going to have the same problem. So, Kant, Hume, Russell, Mill, they totally misunderstand what they are attacking. The third way is from contingency to necessary being. And right away we have to ask, what is contingency? That word is actually not used in this text. Instead, the related words necessity and possibility are used. Let me move over here as I start to go from left to right. But remember, the method of Aquinas is a posteriori, after what you experience, or from effects to causes, and ultimately to an ultimate cause. So what is contingency? It's just the starting point here. It's the word he means that describes what he's going to lift our eyes up from. So let's see how he says it, and we'll get our handle on how he's using it. He opens off by saying, the third way is taken from possibility and necessity. And it runs thus. We find in nature things that are possible to be and not to be. Stop. He's not talking about two things there. He said, erase the board and start the third way on the board. We find in nature things, and I'm going to call this contingent, things, so he's talking about one thing, that can either be or not be. It could go either way. It is possible for this thing to not be. That's all he means by contingent. Possible to not be. In other words, not necessary. Since they are found to be generated and to corrupt, and consequently, they're possible to be and not to be. So let's pause for a second and notice that when Aquinas speaks of the things of nature as being possible to be and not to be, he just means what we're going to mean by contingent. Contingency is philosophically the opposite of necessity. It means that which depends for its existence, depends for its explanation on something more real in itself. It is contingent on, dependent on, something more necessary. It has being, or rather it participates in being. It exists, but it does not subsist. Its being is not necessary. Its essence is not to be. The essence of that thing is not to exist. And that implies that every one of its properties is an effect. So let's draw a little circle here. Here's what I mean by the thing. Let's imagine it as a kind of pie chart. Those sections just representing all of its different predicates. If I was to take every single one of them away, not one of them would be to exist. Namely, I could reduce it to nothingness, which implies that every single one of its predicates is an effect. So you see why this is going to go in the same direction? A contingent thing has nothing but predicates or properties which are effects. Now, once you define this and see this, you make sense of the continuation. He says, but it is impossible for these always to exist. For that which is possible not to be at some time is not. Therefore, if everything is possible not to be, then at one time there could have been nothing in existence. Stop right there. That's going to sound speculative, and that's going to be where the wedge of the objections is going to go. We'll come right back to it, though. He says, now, if this were true, even now, there would be nothing in existence. Because that which does not exist only begins to exist by something already existing. Just like that act in being before. Therefore, if at one time nothing was in existence, it would have been impossible for anything to have begun to exist. And thus, even now, nothing would be in existence, which is absurd. Now, that definitely is absurd. And no doubt most people would agree with Thomas that if at one point nothing existed, then nothing could come into existence now. Nobody's going to disagree with that. But we might ask, does it follow that the contingency of all things would imply such a state, would necessitate such a state? Has he shown that? Hold that thought. Let's listen to the finish. He says, therefore, not all beings are merely possible, but there must exist something, the existence of which is necessary. But every necessary thing either has its necessity caused by another or not. Now, if it is impossible to go on to infinity in necessary things which have their necessity caused by another, as has already been proved in regard to efficient causes. By the way, sorry, get used to that, as has already been proved. The whole thing of the Summa Theologica is to take you on a system of as has already been proved, which means there's a right way to think about everything. I'm going to prove it, and I've already got this far. We're going to keep going. And if you flinch, it's because you hate truth. That's why I love Aquinas right there. That's why he's hated. Right there. Because you're brought into that kind of language, which is disgusting to people that hate truth. Okay, so let's go on there. As has already been proved in regard to efficient causes, therefore we cannot but postulate the existence of some being having of itself its own necessity and not receiving it from another, but rather causing in others their necessity. This all men speak of as God. Now, two dimensions to this argument. First of all, most obviously, that absurd state in which nothing exists, from which nothing could come into existence. Nobody's going to disagree with that. If nothing at one point existed, nothing would start. That's not true. A lot of smart people, again, using our tax dollars, actually do believe in self-creation. So ignore them for a second. Ignore people that are so deluded and paid to be so, so the investment's going that way, so it kind of stimulates their delusion. Ignore that class of people for a second. For most normal people, that's not going to be a problem. If nothing existed at one point, nothing could come into existence. Okay, got that. But the other dimension of this argument, more difficult, is the sense in which the nature of contingency in all things necessitates such a state. That's the question. Did he show that? That's going to be the key. Getting our heads wrapped around that deeper point. Now, the first thing today's philosophy student is going to have to forget, wipe out of your mind, just for the moment, is about how possible world language defines necessity as something less than possibility. In other words, in modal logic, in the last 80 years or so, this language of possible worlds, if you've ever heard that, necessity comes to mean, so here's world one, here's world two, here's world three, get the idea. And the idea is to draw out the modes of something's existence. Is it necessary? Is it contingent? Is it dependent on this? Is it possible? Is it impossible? And so on. And so necessity comes to mean the same thing as he means by substantial attributes. So, for example, I am in this possible world Matt Marino. And in this possible world, I am also Matt Marino. But in this possible world, I am a teacher. And in this possible world, I am a circus clown. That is an accidental property of me, and that is an accidental property. But here's what is necessary. But what's happening there in that kind of thought experiment is that the word necessity is coming to mean a part of the possible world. In other words, less than possibility. And that creates some mischief when we're looking at ideas like this. Okay? A necessary thing in this is an attribute that functions within a possible world. And in a manner of speaking, that's true. All necessary things also have to be possible things, no doubt. But that makes them equal to, not less than. Okay? So, on the other hand, to the degree that we even want to use that language, it would be correct to say that all absolutely necessary things are necessary in every possible world. The way Aquinas is using the word necessity here is the right way. So he means necessity as an absolute necessity, which would make it, if you want to use language of possible worlds, necessary in every possible world. So the laws of logic are an example of that. They obtain in every possible world. But we don't mean they're inside of or something you can do without. We mean some being whose necessity makes the necessity of other beings. So what he's doing here is he's moving from this language to some being that is necessary in himself. Because if your necessity is derived, guess what you've got there? That thing that you're calling necessity is really an effect. If your necessity is derived from another, then your necessity is an effect, which argues for something more necessary. Now, in this light, we can start to see what's behind the more understandable objection. It is sometimes held that this third way is guilty of what's called the quantifier shift fallacy. You don't have to know that particular thing, but this is why it's called that. The inference he's making basically goes like this. It moves from everything, every single thing, at some point could not exist if it were contingent. If everything were just like this thing, namely contingent, then at some point, each of those things could not exist. And he's arguing, too, everything at some point did not exist. So, you've got two potential equivocations. Everything here means each thing. Everything here means one thing. And therefore, could not comes to mean did not. And so the complaint is, Aquinas is saying that just because everything could not exist, and therefore each thing on its own did not, therefore there's a point in which everything, one thing, did not exist. The quantifier shift. One atheistic philosopher, even at one point, J.L. Mackey, writing during an age now that we're in which the laws of thermodynamics help this third way, supposes that there may be some permanent material substance in the universe underneath all those contingent things, such as, we'll just call it the cosmos, broadly defined. Maybe that's good enough to be the necessary being. But the question, if we remember Thomas's exact language, is whether a necessary thing derives its necessity from another, or whether it possesses its necessity in itself. Remember, he said, quote, "But every necessary thing either has its necessity caused by another, or else not." Now, it is impossible to go on to infinity in necessary things which have their necessity caused by another, as has already been proved in regard to efficient causes. What did he just do? In other words, he just did the same thing he did in the first two arguments. All three of these are cosmological arguments in that sense, saying that it is impossible for there to be an infinite regress in causes. So, the upshot is this. The complex of existence and essence in things shows that even this thing, existence, is the essence of that substance. It is the essence of that substance to exist, or else it's not. Now, if the essence of that being is to exist, then its existence is necessarily the case. If, on the other hand, the essence of that being is not to exist, then its essence, including its necessity, is derived from another. Okay? But the essence of any composite thing is of necessity of that latter kind. And thus, no thing, no part of its essence can be to exist. Therefore, nothing but a simple, infinite unity can be necessary in itself. Now, Aquinas is going to have more to say about that when he gets to the attributes of God. So, if you're not convinced by that third argument, wait around for when he talks about the simplicity of God. He's going to talk about the unity versus a composite thing. And there, I believe, he'll finish this argument for anybody that needs it finished. So, we can come back to that next week. The fourth way is from gradation to the most perfect being. So remember in your mind, if you want to know what is gradation, well, his argument is going to be that gradation necessarily is a gradation of perfection. That even to speak about gradation is to be speaking about perfection. So you're going to move from gradation to the most perfect being. Sorry, prime mover, motion to prime mover. Efficient cause to first cause. I forgot to fill out our chart here. And then the third argument was contingent being to necessary being. And now this first one is going to be from gradation to a most perfect being. How's it going to do that? And this is going to be really the most Platonic or Augustinian style of reasoning here. But rather than use the language of universals and particulars or essence versus example, Thomas is going to use the language of genus and species to say the same thing. Let's put genus up here. Let's put species down here. And I'm going to put over here with kind of lines to symbolize gradation. And let's put more up here and less down here. Let's hear the way he says it. The fourth way is taken from the gradation to be found in things. Among beings, there are some more and some less good, true, noble, and the like. But more and less are predicated of different things, according as they resemble in their different ways something which is the maximum, as a thing is said to be hotter, according as it more nearly resembles that which is hottest. So that there is something which is truest, something best, something noblest, and consequently something which is uttermost being. For those things that are greatest in truth are greatest in being, as is written in Metaphysics, Part 2. Now the maximum in any genus is the cause of all in that genus, as fire, which is the maximum of heat, is the cause of all hot things. Again, by fire, substitute hydrogen if you want to talk about the sun. Substitute something else. That's not what he's doing. Therefore, there must also be something which is to all beings the cause of their being, their goodness, and every other perfection. And this we call God. Now, I like to call this the argument from predication, because I see a way out of this for people that are just not familiar with this kind of language of Plato. Here's why I like calling it argument from predication, because the identification of predicates in everyday language is the first data that we have to work with here, and it's something that we all have to affirm in anything that can be affirmed at all. So even if you don't use words like more or less in your statements, all of the predicates that we do use fall on this same spectrum. So for example, let me use things that don't use the word more or less, and I'll show you it's the same thing. Collection of blue things. A collection of blue things will vary. But in what will they vary? Blueness or non-blueness? And so on with absolutely any other predicate. And that's why I prefer to call it that, rather than simply gradation, because the focus on the name itself can easily make somebody wander off into some kind of reductionistic objection. But this is Thomas's argument, so I'm not going to deviate. The idea that he brings up is important. And the claim is simply that all such gradation is precisely gradations of perfection. In other words, the very idea of gradation in any statement about anything would be absolutely unintelligible without the being of perfection in our mind. When we talk about gradation of things, again, we're talking about an attribute of God or an idea in the mind of God. So again, this is just sort of this is the realist argument. There's some differences that I get into realism here in my notes. I'm not going to get into it here. There's not really a whole lot of objections to this argument. I think mostly because either people don't understand it, or the critics simply think that they have dismissed Plato already. Any kind of Plato-type talk. Okay, so Plato's not relevant anymore, so they don't even bother with it. There's not a whole lot of famous objections to this fourth way. The fifth way, the fifth and final way, from ends to an ordering mind. Ends, or design, or directedness to an ordering mind, or, if you don't like that, an intelligent designer. This is the way he says it. He says, quote, "The fifth way is taken from the governance of the world. We see that things which lack intelligence, such as natural bodies, act for an end. And this is evident from their acting always, or nearly always, in the same way, so as to obtain the best result." Stop right there. No, what are you talking about? A body's not thinking must be a good respiratory system so that I can not stop breathing. I know, but respiratory systems tend toward breathing, such that if there's a defect from the perfect, you stop breathing. So that's what he's doing. He's not saying that these things actually are thinking, you know, must fall if it's a rock, obeying the law of gravity or something like that. That's not what he means by end. Now, whatever lacks intelligence cannot move towards an end unless it be directed by some being endowed with knowledge and intelligence, as the arrow is shot to its mark by the archer. Therefore, some intelligent being exists by whom all natural things are directed to their end, and this being we call God. Now, the fifth way is a favorite punching bag throughout the modern world. Today there's been a renewed interest because of antipathy toward the intelligent design movement. Now, a lot of Thomas, and Edward Fezzer is one of these guys, are quick to distance this argument from the famous design argument of William Paley in the 19th century. Remember the watchmaker. You find the watch in the woods and so on and so forth, and then you have the intelligent design movement today. Now, that's curious to me that they want to distance themselves. Now, in one sense, it's a correct distinction. There is a difference between the way Thomas was arguing about ends and the way evidentialists have after Paley. For Thomas, the method is not evidential, it's metaphysical. It is true that Thomas is starting with, quote, empirical things, namely things we observe in this world. But he's not doing induction simply as a scientist would and then arriving at some category. He's starting with a nature, with a definition of what an end does. In general, it is a metaphysical insight. And so in that very important sense, it is a much stronger argument than Paley's argument. Nevertheless, this is what I find so curious. I don't know why Fezzer's complaining that much, because really the substance of design is going to be manifest in the evidence. It's going to be the same essential thing called design in both forms of the argument. So I think they should be allies and not, it's a bit nitpicky, I think. But there are other differences to note, and I think they're important. Paley's watchmaker may be nothing more than a deist god who left the watch in the woods and just kept leaving things like watches and things like woods and then kind of backed off. Okay? And there's another difference. We can know more about God because he's not deistic, and apparently in the evidential argument, the certainty with which you can have this is only probabilistic. It's probably something like this. Now, by contrast, the way that Thomas speaks of design as the inherent nature of all things, it's a universal statement. Everything already qualifies. There you have a certainty in knowledge. And there you have a God who is presently acting in all secondary causation. Now, as far as objections that are specific to this, I would tackle Richard Dawkins and the New Atheist objections, except that they so do not understand this fifth argument, they confuse it with Paley, that I'd have to reserve that for another day, because then we wouldn't be talking about Thomas Aquinas anymore. Richard Dawkins, in many of his books, but particularly, not the God delusion, he may have done it there too, but the one I'm thinking of is The Greatest Show on Earth. He so misunderstands these arguments that it's not even worth refuting, because he's not really even attacking the same thing. Maybe if I do a class on natural theology and Paley, perhaps it'd be worth talking about, but not really. These guys just don't even understand the arguments. Finally, let me make an assessment of these five ways. By the way, if you didn't notice all along, each argument is building upon the former argument. You could say that argument five, as has already been proved, is depending on argument four, which is already depending on argument three, which is inside of two, which is inside of one. All S is P, which is P, which is P, which is P. In other words, each of them, you see this, first of all, the method is going from things we observe, the effects, to their cause, but in that, you cannot, they're saying you cannot, must not, you cannot, this is a necessary truth, this must not be the case that this A is non-A. Okay? So, there's an observation in the sense, there's our common experience, and he wants to posit a first cause, or a prime mover, or a necessary being, or a most perfect being, or an intelligent designer. And he's saying, you could not get to here without this. And so one philosopher, Peter Kreeft, a Catholic philosopher, in his book, The Summa of the Summa, really calls all five of these a cosmological argument in form. All five of these are a form of the cosmological argument reasoning. He says there's three premises. The first is an implicit logical principle, he says. The tautology that either there is a first cause or there is not. Pretty uncontroversial. Either there's a first cause or there's not. Now he says in parentheses, the proofs prove that there is a first cause by showing that the alternative entails a contradiction. This presupposes the law of the excluded middle. You say, oh, this is assuming something else. Yeah, but is it irrefutable? Do you disagree with the law of the excluded middle? He says that there can be no middle alternative between two mutually contradictory propositions. Thus, to disprove one is to prove the other. So if you're wondering, is this a proof? What does proof mean? That's another subject for another day. But proof is a strict term in logic. And in here, you have the law of the excluded middle, either A or non-A. If non-A is logically impossible, then A is necessary in every possible world. That is the most certain kind of proof there could ever be. Now, we live in a scientific age in which our minds, because of that, are more reduced to animalism. And when I think of proof, show me, namely, proof has been reduced to the blinky blinky. That's better. That's bigger. Give me an exploding supernova. Show me which hat it's under. That's more proof. That's not proof at all, technically. Everybody Webster back would recognize that as evidence. That's good. That's what science does. But that's not as big as a logical proof. Something mathematically or logically certain. Did Aquinas do that? He did. Because he is relying on the law of the excluded middle. If the alternative to a first cause, a prime mover, a necessary being, a perfect being, or an ordering mind, if the alternative to that is not possible, then it is proven. You see, unless there's a third option, but we show this is being and non-being. There is no third option in this case. That's the first element. There's an implicit logical principle. Now, secondly, there's an explicit empirical datum. In other words, there's something we observe in real life. You say, well, that's not certain. Okay, I know, but he's moving from that to the thing that absolutely is certain. And then thirdly, a metaphysical principle. That's the arrow. That's the thing that connects them. a metaphysical principle which is neither tautological like A, nor empirical like B, but known by metaphysical insight or understanding. For example, if there is no first cause, there can be no second causes, or nothing can cause itself to be. Okay, so you need three things. There's the logical element that's certain. There's the empirical thing that you're drawing up the simple in. And then there's the connection, the insight, the thing he is showing, the demonstration itself. If there's no first cause, then there can be no second. If there's no second, then there can be no other in the series. And therefore, nothing would be true. But something must be true in order for that to be true. The alternative is not possible. It is proven. Period. End of story. Now, this is an extremely helpful chart that's given by Kreeft, laying out these three things. And it's teaching us a lot more than the way a bunch of Catholics happen to think about their favorite thinker and how he did things. There's really only a few basic ways that we can proceed in our reasoning. And it's safe to say, in conclusion, that none of the five ways of Aquinas, none of the five ways of Aquinas have ever sufficiently been refuted by anyone. And therefore, they have only ever been dismissed in the way that they have because the person doing the dismissing has failed to understand the material. So, with that, I will conclude and open it up to questions or comments.